Unlike what often passes for public discussion in the larger public realm, which takes the form frequently of performance or debate, in which the agenda is to decide one side or another right or wrong, these are genuinely intended to be conversations in which folks help one another struggle toward a deeper understanding of the truth of matters. We try to create a space here in Koinonia on forum evenings where obedience to a certain kind of truth can be practiced, a certain kind of truth that is linked deeply to community and to justice and to the kind of wholeness that we stress in the summer theme of a whole new world. So we invite all of you to contribute your thoughts, your reflections, your testimonies, your comments, but to understand that the agenda here is not one of a debate, it's one of a conversation. I've asked three folks just to start the conversation. Two of them are on the teaching staff this week, Anita Hill immediately to my left and Fred Niedner, who has been doing a Bible study, and then Catherine Ostley, who is the program director at the Village. They will simply make some brief observations and comments to get the conversation started, and then the forum is really belongs to you, and I will simply serve as moderator and try to keep us focused and moving along. So let me start by asking Anita to give us a little bit information about the context and the larger framework for the kind of issue that's being posed, which is, to remind you all, the question is, should churches bless committed gay and lesbian relationships? Anita?
Okay. I want to start by talking about the work that's currently being done by a task force within the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, a task force looking at issues of human sexuality, which has published out for our study and deliberation within the church a document called Human Sexuality and the Christian Faith. And the document is one that raises lots of questions, much in the same way that our forum topic is placed this evening as a question before us. And one of the three major areas of concern about sexuality that this group wrestled with and that the document raises before us is the issue of gay and lesbian relationships. The other two issues are sexual abuse and genital sexual relationships outside of marriage. And I want to just lift up some of the pieces that are in here about homosexuality and gay-lesbian relationships. We know that orientation, in terms of sexual orientation, is something that is becoming more and more understood to be a given part of who we are, wherever we fall on that spectrum of human sexuality, from exclusive heterosexuality to exclusive homosexuality or somewhere between. And the document starts with that place, noting that we have known over time that about 10% of the population are gay and lesbian persons, and that there are many gay and lesbian persons who live their lives in faithful, committed relationships, people who are members of congregations. We're not simply talking about an issue of deciding what should happen outside of the church realm, but it's within our own church as well. The ELCA has at this point, I feel, kind of drawn a distinction between orientation and behavior, and at least in the realm of ordination of gay and lesbian people has drawn the distinction to say that it's okay to be this, but you can't do this behavior if you're going to be qualified for candidacy of ordination in our church. We have not set forth those kinds of rule parameters around what it means to be a layperson within the church, so that question still remains before us. One of the things we've been discussing within the task force and looking at marriage is that marriage is one of the few places that we have a total meshing, if you will, of church and state in our society, where we try to keep those things quite separate. But we have a clergy person who is the person who officiates at the ceremony and signs the document, which becomes a legal document, toward which end, should there be a dissolution of that marriage down the road at some point, one has to go before a judge, not back before a person within the church to consider what happens with this marriage. So one of the things we've been posing are, what are the parts that make up marriage? And perhaps that we would leave the term marriage, and talking about gay-lesbian relationships, leave that term as the legal entity that it is within our secular world about heterosexual marriage, and pose it for those of us in the church, heterosexual or homosexual, that we might consider entering into, via some sort of ceremony, a partnership covenant with one another, two people, which could be opposite gender or same gender, and also a parenting covenant. And those could be entered into separately, together. The hope would be that if one was to enter into a parenting covenant, which includes not only those two individuals, but a child as well, that the pair would have already entered into a partnership covenant. I find it a curious thing in our church that we have rites of blessing of houses or a new business or the shrimp boat fleet or our pets that we bring in for blessing of the pets, and yet we refuse to bless the relationship of gay and lesbian people. And the way that I have talked about this with many gay and lesbian people is that they're saying, we feel the blessing of God in the midst of our relationship. And part of what we want to do is to call together our family and friends around us in an acknowledgement and a making of a statement of our covenant to one another, acknowledging the blessing of God that we already feel in that relationship. And I think I talk with people as well who are heterosexual, who talk about marriage in that way. Also, that it's not some magical thing that happens during that hour of a service, but that perhaps the covenant has already been cast between those two individuals, and it has more to do with family and community, the service that takes place that is marriage, or would be the blessing service that we're talking about here. And let me just lift up some of the questions that are raised in this document for our consideration. One of the questions it has here is it possible that committed lesbian or gay relationships might be signs of the transforming love of God's new creation in Christ, a love that is continually crossing old boundaries, or are they somehow violations of God's intention? How might the lack of social protection and recognition for gay relationships encourage promiscuity, or somehow short-term commitments amongst gay people? So how should the church respond to gay and lesbian couples who desire the recognition and blessing of their union? There's another here. Inherent within this discussion of relationships is that we must address the question about whether or not it's appropriate to expect or demand that all people who are gay or lesbian remain celibate. And that raises the question of celibacy as a gift, as a charism, and it's not a gift to which all feel called, either heterosexual or homosexual. So what does that mean in the midst of it? And the other is it consistent for us as a community to continue to lift up a central value of commitment and covenant and yet deny committed gay and lesbian couples recognition and blessing about that relationship?
Thank you. Have you two decided? Why don't you go ahead for a moment?
Okay. I did make myself a few notes after I agreed to do this last night at midnight so that I didn't ramble and could be reasonably concise. I'm usually asked to talk about the biblical perspective on this whole topic, and so I have file folders full of stuff back home in Indiana. The basic point of which is to say that there are many things that the biblical authors in ancient times did not understand as we do today, and most of those things we have decided in modern times we understand a bit better, and we act accordingly. So, for example, while the Bible, the Torah in particular, is exceedingly judgmental about behavior that is normally assumed related to homosexuality, in the very same context that you find that, you find things like this. According to the book of Deuteronomy, if you have a rebellious child who refuses to be obedient to you, you are to take that child to the city gates, explain to the elders of the city what the problem is, and the community is to join in stoning that child to death. We don't do that anymore, because we've decided that we can figure out certain things about why children might be prone to behave that way and attempt to do something about it. Similarly, an illegitimate person, according to the book of Deuteronomy, is to be denied access to the congregation or the assembly of the people of God, and his or her descendants also denied up to the 10th generation. So if you are illegitimate, you are simply out for at least 10 generations. We don't do that anymore. We have a different understanding of that. Also, in the context of the same legislation, it explains that a woman found to have consented prior to marriage to a sexual relationship in which she loses her virginity, she is to be stoned at the city gates. And if someone has helped her to hide this fact prior to her marriage, like her father, for example, he is to be stoned along with her. The next paragraph explains that if, however, the woman was raped, then she shall not be put to death, but the man who did it will pay a penalty of 50 shekels of silver to the father of the girl. So, you know, that's the context of the judgmental things that are said about that and all sorts of other things related to sexuality. And so I generally try to explain that we need to use our common sense and our understanding of human behavior and human genetic heritage and so forth when we try to think about how we should relate to these kinds of things. But the question here tonight is not so much a biblical view as it is the question whether or not we should be, as churches, churchly communities, blessing committed relationships. That is different, in my estimation, than talking about marriage, because as Anita has pointed out, at least in my tradition, Lutheran, a tradition, I'm actually behaving as a functionary of the state. When I perform a marriage, I'm doing the legal thing, signing legal documents, and only a judge can undo it, as she points out. But only as a Christian, churchly behavior can we bless a relationship. So I want to talk about blessing commitment and blessing commitment. I think that one of the few things I would agree with Dan Quayle about is that commitment is rare, at least relatively rare, and intimacy of the kind that can only flourish in the presence of genuine commitment is a sacred and holy thing. And it is the very thing that I believe God created the world for the sake of its existence. Because God said, the one thing that is no good is loneliness. And even for God, the point of the world is for God to be able to have intimacy. And I cannot see how the 90% of us that are heterosexual have the right to say that the 10% who are not should be denied intimacy, denied that gift for which God created the world in the first place. Secondly, I want to talk about blessing commitment, what it means to bless something. The biblical Hebrew verb to bless, the root meaning of it is to kneel, bereik, to kneel. Because what blessing really is a receiving as much or more than it is a giving. The imagery in the biblical language is a blessing means to receive what someone else has to give as a gift. And so when we bless any committed relationship, what we are doing is we are honoring, sanctifying by receiving the gift that a couple will now represent together, because they will be more together than they were by themselves. I believe that is the case with me. I am more of a person rather than less of a person due to the commitment and the intimacy involved in my own marriage. And I presume, because of long conversations that I've had with gay friends, gay students of mine, that it is the same with them. And so I believe that it is appropriate and good and right that churches should bless commitments of such people so that we might receive the more that they have to give on account of their commitment to each other. And I guess I would end by saying that we should also, as churchly communities then, be there not only to rejoice with the new life that people find in the intimacy of commitment, but we should be there as well to grieve with them when those relationships end, as all relationships end, either by death or by some kind of parting.
Thank you, Fred.
Since two people before me have spoken so succinctly and covered most of what I was going to say, but I will finish with a parable and a statement. This parable was told to me three weeks ago. There was a mother and three daughters, and each of those daughters came to her mother. The first came to the mother and said, "Mother, I have met the person with whom I wish to spend my life." And the mother says to the daughter, "And what is it about this person that makes you wish to spend your life with that one?" And the daughter responds by saying, "He is kind and he is generous and he is pure of heart and he loves God." And the mother says, "Then go, daughter, with my blessing for your life together." The second daughter comes and says, "Mother, I found the person with whom I wish to share my life." And the question is, "And what is it about this person that makes you wish to spend your life with that one?" And the response is, "Mother, he is kind and he is gentle and he is pure of heart and he loves God." And the mother says, "Then go with my blessing and spend your life with this individual." And the third daughter comes and says, "Mother, I have found the person with whom I wish to spend my life." And she says, "What is it about this person that makes you want to spend your life with them?" The daughter responds, "She is kind and she is gentle and she is pure of heart and she loves God." The mother responds by saying, "Then go both with my blessings and my prayers, for you have chosen the bravest love of all." I think that the church has, as Fred said, God called us. I believe at the very depth of my understanding that God created us to be in relationship, first with God and with one another. And in the same way, as Fred said, that to deny that kind of intimate relationship, that commitment, has forced people to be in hiding, to hide who they are as people. And I think the church talks a lot about sin, But in my opinion, the church is sinning by not blessing relationships where people can share and love and grow together. I think we sit in churches together many times and celebrate the relationships and marriages of heterosexual people. But the gay and lesbian people, couples that I know, have no opportunity or a rare opportunity to celebrate together with family and friends and within the church setting. And therefore, we create the inability to learn and grow together and become more of what God calls us to be.
Thank you. Okay, so with those opening thoughts and reflections, the floor is open for your comments and reflections on this matter. Should churches bless committed gay and lesbian relationships?
Yes. Comment on what Fred brought up about blessing being a reception of a gift that gay and lesbian couples have to offer the rest of us. Now you said the 90% of us that are heterosexual. I don't think we're all heterosexual. There's about 10% of us that are purely heterosexual, and the rest of us are just in this gray area. But I do believe that there is a gift, and I have learned from my gay and lesbian friends more how to love and more how to celebrate relationship than I ever learned from my heterosexual friends. And I think that there is such a gift of intentionality in relationship that we can receive from the gay and lesbian community by honoring their relationship. And who better to teach me how to love a woman than a woman who loves a woman? And who better to teach the man, the woman who loves me than a man who loves a woman?
So your point would be there that the the church is itself impoverishing its own community life by not receiving the gift in the sense of blessed that Fred was using. Responses to that, or? Yes.
I think what the church should do, not only in a gay relationship, but also in a heterosexual relationship, is to start finding out from the very beginning what is the motivation of these two people to share life together. That's the main point. If it is just only for raw sex or for money or for whatever, then I think the church should withhold that blessing. There is a certain ethic involved.
So your concern really would be that in relationships of whatever kind between two people, that the church do a more thorough job than perhaps it is, or at least
it motivates these people to be together.
In counseling and seeking out and inviting them to reflect upon the nature of their commitment to one another.
The second point, of course, is eventually it will lead to ordination.
The distinction
is in the church. If you bless a gay relationship, you can then not say, well, you cannot become a bishop. Mm-hmm. And that is where the struggle in the church will go. Mm-hmm. And what do you define by ordination? What is ordination?
Okay, thank you. Other comments? If you're up on the second level, I may not be able to see your hand. It's kind of dusky up there, and so you'll need to shout out.
Well, as I understand the viewpoint of the first speaker, that the church should sanctify forms of marriage, is that what was said? was a partnership.
I was saying that we're using the term here of blessing of relationship, and I was saying that with the enmeshment of church and state that has become legal marriage in this country, which is not in some others. Denmark is one of the others. Some of the Scandinavian countries where you go to a legal place to be married and you go to the church to recognize faith commitment about that relationship in that place, and that there's not the kind of enmeshment of church and state there that we have here, that perhaps it might be of help to us to think about separating those two functions within our own realm. And
so
I was
not suggesting that the churches should have marriages and that sort of thing.
Well,
that sort of thing includes,
since marriage carries so much baggage with it in terms of ownership rights, property, inheritance, many legal issues that we, the church, cannot impose upon the state. To add, or perhaps we might talk about as well, should we move into a position of advocacy for those things?
Well, you're stepping back. The Supreme Court has recently said the military could throw out their own sections. Had the right to do that now. So that's a, at least from the legal standpoint.
Right. So what I was posing is that such a partnership covenant or commitment, a blessing of that would be an appropriate way to proceed for us as a church. And that it might be of help to us within the church to help with what is the intention for this marriage, what is your intention about community and your faith, to separate those two things so that legal marriage continues to be a thing where the justice of the peace signs the document rather than the person of the clergy. Does that answer your query to me? Or?
I think that most of the folks who have spoken, as I understand it, have been separating, distinguishing between marriage, this legally binding contract that the state performs, from this blessing of relationships, which is not seen as marriage, but has at least been, by the opening speaker, set forth in a particular way as a receiving of a gift of the intimacy that the two people coming before the church for blessing bring with them,
but
whether or not that happens.
No regality to it.
That's correct.
Because you couldn't do it.
That's correct.
Exactly.
You couldn't draw Social Security and you couldn't do it.
Right.
With all those things.
Right.
Public, so it sends
away. Right.
However, as you raise that question, I raise the question before us as a matter of justice, if we're going to move in this direction, should the church be advocating for that as well?
With the state.
Huh?
With the state.
With the state. On behalf of gay and lesbian people with the state. I mean, I know couples who have been in relationships for many years who, if they have not put in place very complicated legal documents, the person who's been sharing a home with another for years may lose their home and all the property be taken away by the family of the person who has died, and there's nothing legal that binds that together in the way that marriage does.
You should draw a contract to preserve those rights.
Perhaps.
Yeah. Did I see him back? Ed, did you?
Well, just on this last point, one could also perpetuate wills, but I just thought might test that out as a little random sample here in America, just see how many people have a valid, current, enforceable will. At least if we had lawyers in the room, very few of us would raise our hand at that point. And it puts an additional obligation or onus upon people because of their sexual status. And that in turn creates a difficulty for the commitment in our Constitution that the government should not deprive to any person equal protection of the law. Now, as that phrase is construed right now, it's not construed very favorably towards gays and lesbians, because any kind of an explanation for the laws which in fact have a discriminatory impact against them will do in the minds of the court. Whereas if it's racial discrimination or discrimination that is overtly on the basis of gender, then those kinds of discriminatory acts are held by the court to be justified by a more rigorous, compelling explanation of why the government is doing the discriminating. Whereas discriminating against gays is almost taken for granted by the court and not given very much seriousness in the secular legal apparatus. So what you just said is correct. One could make a binding contract, or one could write a will to take care of these things. But in fact, the law of inheritance makes some presumptions about what life would be like if you haven't written a will. And it therefore kicks in some assumptions about family that were the subject of our discussion last week, and sets them out with great specificity in a series of statutes, and they go state by state. But your comment, I think, would then be subject to change in every single one of the 50 jurisdictions. We don't have anything like coherence or uniformity. And I'm, in fact, not aware of any state which has its laws of inheritance drawn up in favor of gays.
And from a practical standpoint, about discrimination, you generally cannot get a jury to be very sympathetic about the relationship, practical matter, around this country. You hardly hear any verdicts in favor of the plaintiff when the plaintiff has been a homosexual. It just can't be done, practical matter. The courts won't treat them like they would women, or blacks now, or the old people. Just a different ballgame. So when you're in the pit and you're trying to, it's all nice and good to say that you've got these rights, but if a company, for example, can fire a person who's got 5 years toward retirement and get away with it, they certainly can get away with this other. And the gay people don't have any rights in courts, because judges aren't sympathetic, and most juries are closed to people who are regulars. We don't have that problem. And this gentleman down here says that 90% of the humankind is in the gray area. That's, of course, something to challenge. I think we all squirm a little bit on that. These are good, wholesome methods of discussing it, and people can do it without getting mad, but there's the practical aspects of it, and it's a long, long way ahead, because it's hard to convince a heterosexual that he should do anything for somebody who's different than he is.
Okay, if you wouldn't mind, let's try to, I think this whole area of inquiry is a very interesting one, work another forum about the legal and constitutional matters. Mm-hmm. And the question that Anita was indicating would be very interesting, whether the churches might advocate on behalf of gay and lesbian people to prevail upon the state to amend some of its current practices in this area. But I think we ought to take a step back and get to tonight's question, and that is simply whether or not churches should bless, in the sense that blessing has been discussed, and we may want to open that up further as to what a blessing is or might be, committed gay and lesbian relationships. Yes, ma'am?
Could anyone speak to the reasons given as to why we should not bless the relationships?
Okay.
Maybe we'd have a better discussion if we kind of had both arguments.
Do you have some reservations about the, or questions?
No, I'm trying
concerns?
To remember what they are, actually. I mean, one is that it's unnatural. What are some of the others?
Well, I mean, I guess to take the role of trying to articulate some of these views, the issue is overlaid with some philosophical understandings about natural law. And that's itself a subject that is so vast and subject to many, many different understandings that it would take some nuancing. But there's an idea about the relationship between sex and having kids that is clearly at the heart of why some would be opposed to blessing these kinds of relationships or friendships or stable permanent relationships, I think was the implication, or stable committed relationships, I think was the implication of the statement that Anita led with and that both of you followed in with. It's that idea of the object of marriage being to have children that kind of fogged up Christian teaching on sexuality for centuries of mistakes. Which is not to say that kids are evil or something like that. I have three kids and 11 and all like that. But, you know, gays.
You've had sex more than three times.
That's right. And I guess with respect to gays and lesbians, they too were children. You know, I mean, you could push that argument to some absurd point, but that it has nothing to do with the natural law of mistake about orientation, but I think, now here I am already kind of rebutting the argument, and that's not what you were asking for. You were asking for a statement of why some would be uncomfortable with giving a word of blessing and in a church setting for this kind of a relationship. And I think that's part of it. Part of it is a biblical argument, and that's set forth at great length in the ELCA study document, and Anita has been reviewing some of those passages. But typically, again, I'm getting into the rebutting, a single word or passage is taken out of its context in the biblical text, and they're ideal to someone like Fred or Anita that's better. But I think those would be the two principal objections. One, some statements in the Bible about homosexuality that appear on the face of the reading to be quite negative. And then this secondary concern, or this secondary philosophical concern, not a biblical concern, about what is marriage about anyhow, and it is, it's okay if it's for having children. And otherwise, sex is not okay. It's evil, it's part of our fallen nature, and it's just a terrible, limiting view of sexuality that got going with Augustine, or this sort of Neoplatonic overlay. I think those are the two principal objections to the question that's posed
okay.
tonight.
Thank you. Yes.
I don't think this is just a matter of philosophical perspectives or something in the head. I think most of the objection is somewhere down here. I'm a pastor, and about 2 months ago, two lesbian women came to me, not members of my congregation, and inquired as a sort of an initial conversation whether I might be willing to officiate. And not wanting to be a Lone Ranger kind of pastor, I went to my church council, and here are some of the responses I got. One person who has a very close friend who's gay and loves him very much encouraged me to do it, said he would support me in doing it. Another person who's very pragmatic said, don't do it, it'll blow the congregation sky high. An older couple who are very committed to the scriptures and trying to deal with decades of another perspective. They've been in Missouri Synod most of their lives. were willing for me to do it, but the woman said, you wouldn't do it in front of the altar, would you? Another man said, I'd really object to you doing it. If you perform this kind of ceremony, it would cheapen my marriage. So I think a lot of the, this is a good question. This is a very contemporary question for me. And I think a lot of, so the question, should the church do it, is really not a, should my church do it? Should this pastor do it? And for most people, I don't think it's very philosophical. I think for most people, it's homophobia. I think it's emotional, just, this is so new. And at least in sort of rural Northern California, it hasn't been out of the closet for that long. Where most of my congregation is right now, it's okay to be gay. We understand the gospel. We're trying to deal with this. But don't be too upfront about it. Don't be too public about it.
The kind of qualified acceptance.
Yeah, real
position.
Real.
Thank you for that story. I think that really does help.
So those are some of the, besides the biblical objections that a lot of people raise, those are some of the kinds of comments I have heard recently.
Yes, ma'am.
It's interesting, as you were telling your story, and I was thinking back to our congregational meeting to decide whether or not we were going to have communion every Sunday instead of first and third Sunday. And I almost could go right down the road.
She's in
my experience.
What do you think?
It's changed.
What do you think
you
was
do
behind
it very the, in the
you can
the
do it. You can do that, but not in front of the altar. See,
well,
that to me is real. When I said I think the church is sinning,
yeah.
It's a pretty strong statement. You all kind of sat there and looked at me. But what do you think's behind that?
Uncertainty that this is real legitimate, I think. I know the woman. I know who she is, and for her it was reflecting her struggle to be open, but her inability to see this as acceptable as
yes,
heterosexual.
I think that sort of reflects the notion that homosexuality is a sin. And I am really pleased to hear a Lutheran-based congregation or group even discussing the question. In my faith tradition, where I think that, at least in my area of the country, I still feel unwelcome as a lesbian woman coming to the church, period, let alone as a person who wants to celebrate and honor a commitment. So I think that homosexuality really is being viewed still as a sin in many faith traditions and congregations, and that's the question, rather than, and this is like 100 yards forward in a 110 yard dash in terms of what I perceive we're dealing with in many areas of the country. So I think that question has to be addressed and education made in that area before we can even realistically discuss whether or not those commitments will be honored in the church. I feel not welcome as a faithful member, let alone as a committed partner.
Yes, Mark.
I think another one of those deep fears comes from what are we going to say to our kids? What are we going to say to the children who, when they see us blessing a homosexual relationship, when they say, well, why are you doing that? You know, we're going to have to change our whole Sunday school curriculum and include a different option. And I think that's frightening to all of us. You know, we don't want to allow our children to see that opportunity because we're afraid they might choose that. We're afraid that they might be open about their sexuality and not get railroaded into heterosexuality. A lot of the hardest questions come from children because they see things so honestly. And we try and shield so many things from them. And it really puts gay and lesbian children through a lot of pain to not see what they feel. I can't speak from experience, I only speak from what I know, but to not see what they feel as their natural tendencies blessed, accepted. So I think that's another one of our fears, is what are we going to say to our kids? We're going to have to present, by blessing a committed relationship, we are blessing gays and lesbians. We are blessing that way of life. We're blessing that natural tendency. Which means we're going to have to explain it to our kids, little kids.
Okay, yes, sir.
I think where the church should start is teaching tolerance. We have never been very strong in teaching tolerance. And if we can teach not to love your neighbor, but also to love the other, which is different, then we may open it up to the point that we can say, let's give the other thing another blessing. Basically, we are scared of it because it's different.
I would pose that the command to love ones, that there's a one up, one down inherent in tolerate, or even in the word to accept, that leaves somebody in the position of doing the accepting. I make the decision of whether you're acceptable or not. And that perhaps we need to rethink our language about toleration and acceptance.
Yeah.
They sound like pretty good things. You know, we should be tolerant, we should accept other people. But the commandment is that we love the neighbor as ourselves, which is not just a tolerant.
Neighbor, my neighbor is the same as I am, the same house, the same income, the same car.
Is it?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that's a good one, is it?
No, we first have to define that the neighbor is more than your next door neighbor.
Right.
So call it the other.
Okay. Good.
Yes, ma'am.
I struggle as a new Christian coming to the church and coming as more open-minded and accepting. And the longer that I've been in the particular congregation that I am, becoming what I feel is to be closed-minded and not accepting of differences. And part of the struggle for me is in looking at scripture, knowing how do we decide, how do we know scholarly what was due to, you know, what was cultural, what can be explained away, why can some things be explained away, you know, say, well, that was then and this is now, but some things are relevant. And how, you know, I want to, my inclination is to you know, be accepting, to, you know, to be, I don't want to say tolerant, because I don't want to say, you know, that there's a, that to look at it equally. But then there is that nagging doubt, I have to admit, in me that says, but how do we know? You know, how can we say, when it seems to be here in black and white, you know, I think you're right. I think you're right on that. It's not anything about that. It's about, is it okay or is it not okay?
Sounds like one for you, Fred, the question about sorting that kind of. Do you have any words of wisdom on that?
Well, not really, except that it seems to me that the communities, anybody who uses the Bible, whether it's communities or individuals, make decisions for themselves about what they're going to take as irrelevant to the present circumstance and what they're going to choose to uphold. And so there is no such thing, in my estimation, as any pure objective some perfect way to use the Bible that has all the irrelevant stuff sort of dropped out and all the relevant stuff preserved. That's what we choose. We choose to live a certain way and use the Bible accordingly is what it basically amounts to.
You were going to say something.
Well, I think at some level, if we're to live as Christians, the call to justice that's equally as much a gut response from a faith position to do what is a calling of loving one another. Beloved, let us love one another. And when we force people underground, when we refuse to allow people to live out their lives as the ones for whom they are, then I think we are no longer doing justice. I think we are responding in going against what our call is and following Christ. And to me, the little dotted I's and so forth biblically mean less than the life of Christ, the life of Jesus, and the love and calling for one another to be living lives of justice.
Perhaps one way of going a little further with this would be to ask the group whether or not they think, getting back to this pastor's story about his church council, I'm wondering whether or not the way the question has been unfolded this evening is helpful in that it would tend, and I'm asking all of you, imagining yourselves for a moment as members of that church council, and he's come to you with this situation and asked for your counsel, and maybe one or the other of you can identify with one of the positions taken by those various parishioners. But the way of unfolding the question tonight obviously is somewhat different from the way it's often put. That is to say, for one thing, in talking about blessing the way we have, as receiving a gift, and talking about the gift as being one of intimacy and commitment, okay? And talking about commitment in an ethical sense, that the commitment is based upon profound mutual regard and care for one another's well-being, and that this is then lifted up for blessing by the local church, and that it's not to be equivalent to marriage. That's a different legal and state matter, okay? I'm wondering if those kinds of distinctions that have surfaced and that kind of clarity would have helped you and others here imagining themselves to be on that council to have given favorable and supportive counsel to the inclination to go ahead and bless that relationship. So I'm wondering if it's helpful to have put the question this way to the folks here.
Well, I think I have a story that's a little different than the church council story that we heard from over here, but I related to what you were talking about, because I sat at a church council in a congregation that I'm a member of a few years ago, where we had our pastor came to us and said, I have a very interesting situation on my hands and I would like to get some congregational response. And she said that in the very same day, she had two couples come to her wanting to be married in the church sanctuary, which is in New York City. And one of them was a lesbian couple who had been members of our church for about 10 years. And they had been in a relationship for 6 of those 10 years. And they were strong church members, and there was no question in any of our minds that they were faithful people, and they had been together for this period of time. And they were asking if she would be willing to perform a serving of a service of blessing for them. And the same day, a couple came in that she had never, a man and a woman came in, she'd never seen them before. And the woman said, well, my grandmother is a member of this church, who the pastor didn't know. I mean, she was not on the rolls. And they said, we've always loved this church, and we've been here to worship a few times in the last few years, and it's very nebulous. And so, and she said, well, what should I do? I mean, I have on the one hand, I have this couple here, which I'm very sure of their relationship, and I'm very sure of their commitment to the church, and I'm very sure of their faith commitment. And on the other hand, I have a heterosexual couple who a lot of pastors marry, but they would just marry them. And I ask a lot of questions, and I expect them to be members of any church, and I expect them to be anything but what they were, a heterosexual couple, which is the acceptable way to be in our society. And so we as a church council had to struggle with what that meant. And I think for our church, what it meant was it was an issue that was very personal, in the sense that we were no longer talking about, you know, people or foreigners. We were talking about
people who are church members who we knew very confidently where they stood, and it was a different perspective for all of us having to deal with in the church.
Yes, Mila.
I wanted to not to steer away from this important discussion about the church council, how a pastor will respond, but just to say about up to about 1985, the statute books in South Africa defined an immorality act as marriage across racial lines. And it was very specific. No pastor and no church was to bless that marriage. And a church synod sat like this to discuss, should we bless a marriage of a black and white? And people answered from God's building, how are we going to, where are the children going to stay, where will they go to school, and all sorts of things. Maybe the Bible says it's wrong, etc., etc. It sounds interesting to me that it looks like it's more or less the same situation, except in this case it's a different kind of definition. And it was interesting because at the end the church waited for the state to redefine what is a normal marriage. And after 1985, when the statute books were changed, the Immorality Act was scrapped, then that was no longer a problem. Now, I'm not sure whether, assuming a state in the US says like Denmark is okay, what will the synodical churches in that state say? If maybe Illinois state say it's okay, will the Metropolitan Synod in Chicago pastors still debate whether it's right or wrong?
Thank you for those two stories, because they really do help to put a perspective on this whole question that is two different perspectives. It's very useful. I mean, you pointed the story that you told, it seems to me, is that it helps us see, at least helps me see, that really raising this question is to raise questions not simply about gay and lesbian relationships, but about the kind of relationships that the church blesses. That is to say, it reorients the question toward intimacy and commitment, and away from legalities and certain conventions that are just... that the church gives its imprimatur to without sufficient regard for the ethical dimension of the relationships of the human beings involved, whether or not it's heterosexual or gay or lesbian. And then your story really helps all of us, I think, to see ourselves here in this conversation in a way that others from other vantage points might see us, and I think there was some, at least in my own part, shocks of recognition here that this kind of conversation may seem to others as absurd as to some of us in here, the conversation you reported in South Africa would seem. Yes, I think we've got time for, let's say, two more comments. You have your hand up, and then let's call on you first, and then you, and then that'll be, you'll have the last word. Yes.
Well, in our congregation, I think we're on about 5 yard line in this 110-yard dash. And we have tried to bring discussions like this to our congregation, and there's no way you can even talk about it. But I think part of the key is in Gal's comment about knowing people. I think if you know people who have this orientation and they are your friends, it's a totally different question. But if it's just sort of a question that's posed, you think you don't know anybody of this orientation. They're just strange people out there somewhere, but we sure don't know anybody like that here. It's a totally different thing. Maybe someday we'll be able to talk about it.
Yes.
I just had a couple questions just for information. Anita, you alluded to the statement about pastors. the ELCA statement that a pastor could have a homosexual orientation but not participate in homosexual behavior.
Yes.
But I was saying, okay, it's interesting to me to think that an individual pastor or church council could just make this decision. Is there no position of the church? And a broader question is, what do some of the other Protestant denominations say about this? Like, could he have just decided, fine, I'm going to do this? He happened to ask his church council, but does a pastor have that kind of autonomy in the ELCA that he could just do it?
Are there some pastors who want to speak to that?
I shouldn't say just he or she.
Could pastors, why don't you?
Yeah, just about 3 months ago, the pastors in our synod got a strange letter from the church council that said, before you do anything like this, please talk to the bishop. But the whereases were, you know, pastors have exercised their judgment in these kinds of situations and we don't want to interfere with that, blah, blah. So I'm not exactly sure where that came from. It's very strange. I haven't talked to the bishop yet.
We wrestled through a similar thing in my congregation. About 84, 85 was the time period when the question came before, and the pastor again talked it through with church council. And part of their decision making went along with what you were saying, was that in order to do that, we felt it important that at least one person in that couple that wished to have their blessing in that congregational setting was a member of that congregation. And it caused that council to rethink, what is the pastor doing? Does he just marry any heterosexual couple off the street who comes in? Or some, you know, distant grandmother kind of used to go here a long time ago and I went as a child twice and I want to be here now? Or are there people who want to somehow keep their foot in the door in case they die, they need a place to be buried, you know, that kind of connection with church? I was married there so I can be buried there. Arrangement does not very much attend to what is community and what are we asking the community to do and be in a blessing or marriage or how we look at that. And so I talked with many couples when they knew there was such a ministry with gay and lesbian people at that congregation who would call and say, you know, we want to have a ceremony and we want it in a church. Well, part of it was to talk with them about what are your intentions about being part of a faith community if you wish this. Sort of, it was that question of intentionality of what do you want? And some decided to become active members there and be involved in that way, and others not. But that question still is wrestled. Questions about baptizing children when parents have never been involved with a congregation is a similar sort of question. So while I've got the floor, the words that are coming to me instead of tolerance and acceptance are words for us within the church that take a different meaning, are words of welcome and hospitality. Is how we work with other, rather than tolerate and accept.
Thank you. I think that's a good last word, hospitality. I thank you all for coming, for being so thoughtful in this conversation. It is 10 o'clock. We customarily adjourn, so we should let you return to your rooms. Others who want to linger and talk.